Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Between severe storms and near triple-digit temperatures, way high for June, American Electric Power last week said that it was forced to intentionally kill power to customers throughout Columbus. We'll talk about that decision later on in the program, but first, the weather. The extreme heat has returned. What's the deal? NBC4 meteorologist and environmental and science reporter Ben Gelber joins us. Ben, welcome back.
Thank you, Ann. Good to see you.
All right. Can you put that last? We're going into another heat wave this week. It might not be as extreme as last week, but can you put last week into context?
Well, I think the big story last week, we didn't break any record high temperatures. What we did break was what we call our record high dew point temperature, which I teach meteorology now at Ohio State. The simplest definition is that's a great way to measure how much moisture is in the air. Even better than the relative humidity, which is relative to the temperature. So the dew point reached 83, 84 degrees, we'll say between about 5 and 7 o'clock last Tuesday evening. That's the highest that's ever been officially recorded by the National Weather Service, formerly the U.S. Weather Bureau, in Columbus. One little asterisk that we sample data more frequently versus hourly years ago. So it's possible we may have touched that at another time. But either way, it's as humid as it has ever been. And then you couple that with temperatures in the low 90s, and not one, not two, but three thunderstorm systems that blew through Ohio between late afternoon Monday and daybreak on Tuesday. So you had a perfect storm.
No pun intended.
Exactly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're going to talk about the American Electric Power response to the storms and the heat in recent weeks. But first, we're talking with Emmy Award-winning meteorologist for NBC4, Ben Gelber, about the weather. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we always say up north here, it's not the temp heat, it's the humidity. And it really was the humidity then last week.
Right. And I can attest to that visiting my son in Phoenix not too long ago. When we got there, it was 99 degrees. And frankly, it felt like a day in the maybe mid to upper 80s here. Here we get into the low 90s, and it felt like, at least instantaneously, 117 last Tuesday at 6:45, and much of the day between 105 and 115, that being the feels-like heat index, coupling temperature and humidity. So that's essentially off the charts. Even on Wednesday, the heat index topped out at 105 before the numbers began to come down a little bit. So Gulf Coast weather, as I called it this weekend in a storm wrap-up, on top of that was fueled by what we call these thunderstorm complexes, and they feed off this intense humidity, and it becomes self-sustaining because that moisture is then put back into the air with heavy rain, and then it just sits, almost like a tropical rainforest or subtropical humid climate.
The fact that it was record high dew point, so record high humidity, is it relevant that it was June and not August?
Yeah, and you're right, Ann. The previous record had been set on July 26th of 1997, which was 81, and the previous record high heat index, which again includes the temperature and humidity on a slightly hotter day, was July 15th of 1995. So yes, the records are normally reached and the highest levels in the month of July, particularly mid to late July is the hottest time of the year statistically. So yeah, we have to consider this is happening in June. Ask the folks in Europe right now who are also experiencing a historic heat. It's never been hotter in spots between Spain and Germany in June, middle of June. And of course, we should add today, as of a little after 5 this morning, is the first official day of summer. So we're off to an early start.
Longest day of the year.
That's correct. Just over 15 hours of daylight.
And it's going to be a hot one.
Yeah, today is hot. The humidity is not going to reach last week's levels, as you mentioned. But we should be right back to somewhere between 93 and 95, depending upon where you live around the region, over the next couple of days. Good news is that a cold front will come through. I use the term cold front in quotes.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, a cool front will come through later tomorrow. So that will drop us back into the mid to upper 80s on Thursday with lower humidity. So it won't be, but we are going to inch back into the low 90s over the weekend. So this may be, it's too early to tell, may be a recurring theme. It's certainly going to take us out of June into July on a very warm note.
Can you predict humidity?
Yes. Our models not only help us with temperature, but also with dew. You can actually get a printout of dew point temperatures over many days in advance. And I can interpret longer range models to get a sense of how much moisture there is in the air. So we can see these humid air masses that generally get trapped under what we call a heat dome. And they're, the broader term, really, we used to talk about the Bermuda High when I was growing up. But this is more of a Sonoran high-pressure area, the Sonoran Desert of northern Mexico into the southwestern U.S. That's really the origin of the heat. But as that builds to the east and the and to the north, for, at least in our part of the world, and high pressure goes east of us, clockwise winds come out of the Gulf. So what may start as a desert heat by the time it gets to us is modified, usually, unless the winds are more westerly, which happens occasionally. But with a southwest or south flow, it's going to get steamy very quickly.
Does the fact that it was this huge mass of a heat wave, it seemed to almost cover a third of the country, maybe more, all at the same time. Is there relevance to that?
Well, I'll just say that's actually pretty common because the jet stream is in retreat, that being the high altitude winds, steering currents up where the jet airplanes fly, and that those winds are another thing we model over days and weeks. But I think what's interesting in the past week is we had an unusually deep plunge of the jet stream down the West Coast, which, if you kind of see that configuration, it creates what we call an omega block, the Greek letter omega, where you have a deep dip in the west, a big arching ridge in the central states, and then a big dip in the northeast. So that traces out the letter omega. More importantly, that type of flow, first of all, brings cool air into the western states, like a giant seesaw. And then as you come around the bend, you pull moisture from the Pacific and the Gulf of California into parts of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah that are getting an early start on the North American or Southwest monsoon, which is seasonal, but that's good news. They desperately need the rain. But then you follow that arch up into southern Canada, and so that's the heat dome. Now, what happened this weekend, it got pinched by the next dip down the line, which or downturn in the jet stream, which was right over us, the Great Lakes, to the mid-Atlantic. So we got into a northwest flow, and suddenly we were in the 70s and lows in the upper 40s by Sunday morning. But that's getting shoved back toward New England and the Canadian Maritimes. So now the heat dome, again, expands to the east. And it kind of expands, contracts relative to the jet stream, and which obviously is globally connected. It's not just us, but in response to other changes in the winds.
Right. Weather doesn't recognize political subdivisions.
No, it's definitely, that's why we need international data and always have to see the whole flow, the whole picture.
What do you think, I mean, is there a way to explain the role of the changing climate in these episodes, or is it still, as you've said before, too much of just a snapshot in the moment and it would take years to put it into that kind of context?
Well, I mean, I think there are two ways to look at this. As you said, these are transient weather features that have always been with us. We've had heat waves for time immemorial, but we can quantify certain changes, whether it's the frequency of heat waves or, as I like to look at, the frequency of high dew point days, I think is more relevant. In other words, is the amount of moisture in the atmosphere increasing? Because then we bring in the physics. That requires broadly a warmer atmosphere to evaporate more moisture into the air from the Gulf, from the Atlantic, from the Pacific. And we do know, and you know, you start with hard data rather than looking at a weather situation and trying to find the conclusion that you're looking for, mm-hmm. which unfortunately happens a lot, and we all do that. But in this case, let's start with what we know. We know that water temperatures, sea surface temperatures, are on the rise by a couple of degrees in concert with land temperatures. So the atmosphere now potentially has more capacity to hold moisture. Some places get drier, some places get wetter, because now you have to factor in what goes up must go down. The air is rising in some areas. That's conducive to clouds and thunderstorms, and the air therefore has to sink in other areas, which is a drying effect, and so you can get hot, dry, such as the U.S. Southwest. At the same time, you get hot, humid in the east. But you can't argue that the fact that the atmosphere is warmer and wetter for how wherever you however you look at the big picture, and that in turn is making these heat waves more uncomfortable, but also more common. Now, I also point out in class you have to extend the timeline. We can absolutely go back to the 1930s and find all-time heat that exceeds what we see now. Temperatures as high as 106 twice in Columbus. You may say, well, it's been hot before. Exactly. That was a dry heat. We would not have gotten to 106 with the kind of humidity levels we have, because when it gets very muggy, the sun has to spend some of its energy evaporating that moisture. So there are different types of heat. And yes, we've been very hot before and always have. But the long-term trend certainly points to, regardless of where you how you decide how much is climate change, but it's not really up for discussion, because, again, we have all the data and we can show that. We can show dew points are also rising. In other words, the absolute amount of moisture in the air.
Is it making your job harder?
It's made it more intriguing because, for those, in my case, I've been doing it for 4 decades, and then plus your childhood memories, you tend to see weather situations, based on maybe another era where we had a more predominantly west or northwesterly flow in the jet stream, and the atmosphere was a little drier, and winters were measurably colder and in many degrees snowier for those of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s, for example. And you have to reapply your knowledge of, as we mentioned, physics and the science. Of course, we have far more weather models than when I started. But I think our notions of thunderstorms, for example, being the popcorn type, but we're getting more deep drenching downpours because of that higher moisture content, and we have to forecast for that. So your mindset has to be that if there's more available moisture in the air, some of these storms, and that includes more slow-moving hurricanes capable of, like Harvey and many others, dropping more moisture than even what the forecast models show in response to higher moisture and higher temperatures.
The slow-moving hurricane issue or any kind of system like that, why the pace? What determines the pace of a storm?
Again, it comes back to the jet stream. Now, the tricky part is, do we attempt to tie that into climate change? Mm-hmm. And, of course, everything is inextricably connected. The theory goes that the jet stream and therefore storm motion, as these storms are moved by the, we'll say, mid-level winds, maybe 5, 10, 15,000 feet or higher above the surface, is becoming loopier and therefore slower on average. And again, the key words, on average. There are infinite variations. But if you're looking at long-term studies, we know these storms are slowing down. Maybe it's 10 or 15% slower, and you say, well, that's not that big a deal. But it is when these storms can produce 3, 6, 8 inches of rain in an hour.
They're slowing down and they're producing so much
precipitation. So the rain sits for longer periods of time. And I absolutely remember, as a kid following, tracking hurricanes, we used to get sheets and we'd plot the longitude lat
Sure you did.
Or I would anyway. And because that's all we had. Yeah. And whether it was TV or teletype, you know, that information, we didn't have internet, of course, to do that. But, you know, storms came and went. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, but many of the East Coast storms, you know, these are quick blasts. They were intense, but nothing really lingered. My first experience with that was Agnes, which this is the anniversary of Hurricane and then Tropical Storm Agnes that did slow down, get caught up in a loopier jet stream, and what was supposed to be several inches of rain became a foot and a half of rain and caused historic and devastating flooding in my neck of the woods in parts of Pennsylvania, New York, all the way down to Maryland. That was the first storm I can recall. And obviously that predates some of these climate changes we're talking about. And that is important to show, of course, these things can happen across the spectrum of weather and time. However, it's not about whether an event happens, is it happening more often? You know, on a more simple basis, are we having 100-year floods, which aren't meant to happen once every 100 years, but are they happening more often? Are we seeing a clustering of either slow-moving storms or big East Coast snowstorms or heat waves? That's how you get a better – not have we had them before. Of course we have. But are we seeing bunches of a certain type of weather event? That gets your attention, and certainly mine as a climate scientist, should start to ask, all right, what has changed? And that often is a slower, loopier jet stream and higher water temperatures, which is the fuel for these storms.
I just have one more question because I got to let you go, but does topography play a role? I remember when Ike blew through and, you know, was so devastating, and we wondered how in the world could that get all the way up to Ohio? It just didn't seem like it had ever happened before.
Yeah, we've had our share of storms, but we've never had, and we're talking, for memory's sake, September 14 of 2008, we've never had a tropical system rejuvenate. Not because of moisture in this case, but speaking of perfect storms, it came in during the afternoon when it was 90 degrees. So you had perfect vertical, a lot of up and down motions in the atmosphere. So that storm, with its 20 and 30 mile per hour winds, suddenly tapped 100 mile per hour jet stream winds. Again, the jet stream brought those mid-level winds down to the surface. We had 4 hours of tropical storm force winds in Columbus and wind gusts to 75, 80 miles an hour, something we've never seen before.
Yeah.
That's an example, and that gets your attention too. If we have no history, at least in the last couple of hundred years, of a system like that, of course it could be a fluke, but that's all part of the climate studies that go into understanding what's happening today.
Well, Ben Gelber, I have to let you go, but thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Always love to talk to you, Ann, and thanks, everyone.
That's Ben Gelber, Emmy Award-winning meteorologist for NBC4. Now we're going to turn for the rest of the program to how the American Electric Power responded to the weather events in the last week or so and what it portends moving forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Between severe storms and near triple-digit temperatures, way high for June, American Electric Power last week said it was forced to intentionally kill power to customers throughout Columbus and the region. Ratepayers want to know why. AEP declined to provide a spokesperson for the show today. Cleveland-based attorney and climate reporter Kathy Ann Kowalski reports regularly for the Energy News Network. Kathy Ann Kowalski, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, glad to be here.
So in April, you worried about storms straining Ohio's electric grid and climate change that could make it worse. How so?
Well, generally speaking, Ohio, it has already seen warmer climate and a wetter climate. Warmer air can hold more moisture, and that increases your chances for rain. And note Ben's comment also that we had a very high dew point, right? So more moisture in the air means more chances for rain. That doesn't always mean thunderstorms and high winds and all that, but usually, you know, often when you have a thunderstorm, you've got rain, right? So we are in a situation where we're looking at more of those conditions happening. We're already seeing a slight shift in the tornado region of the country, edging into parts of Ohio. And, you know, these trends are predicted to continue as climate change continues.
How is this factored into the calculations of the likes of AEP, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, the Consumers Council of Ohio? I mean, how are they thinking about all of this right now?
They're generally thinking in terms that they thought about 20 and 30 years ago. There are new regulations in place, but they don't specifically mention climate change as a factor. There's a bill pending, the Energy Jobs and Justice Act, that would call for regular reports on progress in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. But overall, we have not seen the PUCO or Ohio lawmakers so far take action to really address climate change and not just continuing reliability of the grid, but resilience of the grid to be able to bounce back faster. The utilities say they're taking actions, but again, nothing, it's less official.
What do we know about what actions they would take to preemptively address the changing climate and its impact on the grid?
So far, AEP and First Energy have said that they're looking into and starting to install more automatic switch-off equipment that would make it easier, you know, in theory, to just shut off when a wire is overheating or there's an equipment problem and then arguably come back online faster. Dayton Power and Light last year said in response to a lot of the severe storms they had, they were looking to have sturdier telephone poles for the wires.
Okay.
Makes some sense. the you know, there are other measures that have been taken or looked at. For example, coatings on wires to try to make them more likely to shed moisture. Not as much of an issue in the summer, but in the winter, you don't want ice buildup.
Mm-hmm.
Better relays, and in part, when PJM said, we've got overheating, they were getting messages early on, and their theory is to try to have smaller outages in order to prevent more widespread regional problems of the likes that we had back in 2003 when there was a problem in the First Energy territory and knocked out much of the Northeast.
Right, that was freaky. Can you explain what PJM is?
Sure, PJM is PJM Interconnection. They are like a traffic cop for the regional electric grid. And they include 13 states or part of 13 states, plus the District of Columbia. In order for the grid to work, you need a balance of power. And I don't mean parties fighting with each other. I mean, you need as much electricity going onto the grid as customers are taking off the grid. And that needs to be taken care of 24 hours a day. If you get too much demand and the supply isn't matching up, you have problems. If you have something interrupting what's going on in the flow, then all of a sudden you've got no place for electricity to go or continue on the circuit, and that causes problems. So there are all sorts of things that can go wrong And the grid actually has many thousands of pieces and parts. And, you know, that's what these folks outside of Philadelphia in Valley Forge are trying to manage.
And so they ordered AEP, one of these member utilities, to pull back, to shut things down.
Correct.
And that's what AEP did when they shut down. They intentionally shut off power to all these thousands of Central Ohioans and beyond.
Correct.
And, now, yeah, go ahead.
Now, one of the things is, again, that can prevent more widespread damage, trying to find out exactly what made certain lines or circuits more vulnerable has been somewhat problematic. PJM said in a statement, we told them to shut it down to eliminate, you know, overheating on certain areas and so forth. AEP says we were told to shut down, but questions about what makes certain lines more vulnerable, what made certain stations more vulnerable, we don't have full answers to that yet.
Is there an obligation anywhere out there for AEP to provide those answers?
They are supposed to provide annual reports to the PUCO. The PUCO has said they will look into things, but we don't know how swiftly that will move. This year, we did not get reports on outages from last year until the end of March. And interestingly enough, there were more people affected by last week's major outage in the AEP Ohio territory than for all four major outage events in AEP's territory last year.
So this is a really big event. Right. And so when PJM orders AEP to pull back, so they got to shut down things, does it leave the discretion of where to shut things off to AEP?
It does not leave the discretion of where to shut things off to AEP. Where discretion might exist, maybe in where resources get targeted for system hardening.
What does that mean? And,
it's unclear to me, at least yet, whether there are steps or equipment that could have been taken to make certain lines less vulnerable.
Okay, preemptively.
Right.
Okay, and when AEP shuts off the lines to the region such as it did, so in the most populous parts of the city, is that a function of how they had to shut down a lot of power fast and better to do it, hypothetically, better to do it there than the outskirts where things are more sparsely populated and the demand is possibly lower?
According to a statement I got from their spokesperson yesterday, they said it was dictated by where lines were most likely to cause larger problems and the substations affected by that.
Oh, okay.
And so they said that precluded rolling brownouts.
And so I guess the question is, they say, no, we didn't shut down the power to poorer areas of the city because they're the poorer areas of the city, but in a preemptive way, the equipment that is involved in those areas is not apparently not as well maintained, is not maintained in the same. I'm not sure how to put this, but
I don't know if it is or isn't.
Okay, we don't know. We just don't know.
And I'd like to know.
Yeah. So again, when it comes to the storms blowing through, that's one thing, but in a maintenance way, are they taking? Is the equipment in those areas as well taken care of as it is in other areas?
Right.
Okay.
And while last week's outages were, affected many, many people. I mean, there were outages not just in AEP territory, but up in First Energy territory down in Cincinnati and yeah. so forth. Just 6 months earlier, there were more than 250,000 people affected by a December 11 storm and high winds. So we are having, I can't say more frequent, because there isn't a long enough period of data for that, but it's not a deer in the headlights thing. These storms and these major outage events are happening.
Let's talk about what kind of obligation the company has to inform its customers, A, that it's going to be shutting down the power, and B, how to, I mean, is there any kind of obligation, any duty that's prescribed, say, by Public Utilities Commission or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
That's strange to me.
It's distressing, in part because although the map would show here are the outages, and then they did put up little tent icons to show where you can go for shelter, if you could get that information beforehand, perhaps you could take some steps.
like empty your freezer out or do something. And then there was that glitch about whether or not AEP was liable for the losses due to the unexpected shutdown.
Right. And they are saying they are not liable. And it's funny, they say they are not liable, but they were donating 1 million to one source, and then they had an extra 2 point something million dollars in another neighbor to neighbor fund that was going to be available. And those are for, that's for customers in economic need. But there's still a whole lot of people that lost money. And someone on Twitter said, well, $1 million, and you take the number of people, and maybe that's $5. And while insurance may cover it for some people, a lot of people can't afford insurance.
Is anybody talking about an alert system that is more useful to everyday people?
I have not heard of one yet. It would be a great idea.
Do we know if any place has those kind of things?
No, I don't know offhand.
Because I'm kind of thinking if this is going to become more, unless they do something and wave their wand and do something to change the grid system as such as it is.
I mean, you can change the grid system.
Okay, so they can update it. They could make these improvements that would make it less vulnerable.
Right, they can make improvements that would make it less vulnerable. They also, one of the things in the Ion Utilities newsletter that's out today, several people were saying, House Bill 6 made things a lot harder.
How so?
It gutted energy efficiency standards, for one thing. And when you have energy efficiency standards, you're encouraged. And the, so if you could have reduced the demand, that may have taken some of the pressure. And if you had renewable energy standards still in place, you might have had more of those kinds of resources available for places, or at least an incentive for more. There's money that's been going to coal plants that theoretically could have been used for some of this upgrade work. And so, those are a few things. Other things that could be done on the grid, and AEP did say it was looking at this for perhaps hospitals, is you can have microgrids set up. And one of the things the Cleveland Area Resilience Plan was looking into was having this little downtown square that would be 99.999% reliable. And the idea is you could wall yourself off from the rest of the grid when a power develops. And Cleveland Clinic, I think, already has something like that.
Kathy Ann Kowalski, that's all the time we have right now, but I really appreciate it. I hope we can call on you again. I appreciate your time.
It'd be great. Thanks for having me.
Kathy Ann Kowalski is an attorney and journalist. She's based in Cleveland. She reports regularly for the Energy News Network, Ion Ohio, and other publications. Coming up, we're going to turn to the question of Texas and how it manages these days. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. While extreme heat taxes power grids across the country, Texas is in part managing the increased demand with wind and solar energy. University of Texas at Austin Research Associate Joshua Rhodes works in the area of smart grids and the bulk electricity system. Joshua Rhodes, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we were just talking about how this legislation that was enacted in Ohio reduced, kind of gutted energy efficiency standards, and the wind and the solar infrastructure's just not there to step up. The rhetoric in Texas has been anti-renewables. Do you think the performance of renewable energy is changing people's minds in Texas right now?
Well, renewables in Texas are an interesting sector. Renewables have the support of rural Republicans, where a lot of this infrastructure is going. It's economic development in areas that typically don't see it, as well as urban Democrats for, being green. So it does make for some interesting bedfellows, and Texas does have the most wind of the next five states combined.
Right. It's rich in certain kinds of resources when it comes to energy, right?
Almost all forms of energy, pretty much. Texas is an energy state.
Let's talk about, can you explain Texas, the fact that Texas has its own power grid and what's going on with that?
Yeah, so there's basically three connected electricity grids in the U.S. There's the Eastern Interconnect, which is basically the Rockies East, the Western Interconnect, the Rockies West, and then Texas. So Texas is an island of its own electricity, meaning that we're not connected to other states, that our power grid is not connected to, our neighbors like other states are. And so that means that we're able to have a little more self-determination. We're not as regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, like other states are, and it allows us to do some things that are a little bit different than others.
What are the pros and cons of that? What are the positives about that?
The positives is it generally allows us to move a little quicker if we want to make market changes or do some kind of infrastructure upgrades. A lot of times the building of things like transmission lines can get bogged down between multi-state bodies that, everyone has to agree to something. And that's hard to get a lot of people in a big, a lot of people in a room to agree to something. And when we're doing it, we really only have to get the just the local buy-in for that.
And then the downside?
The downsides were on pretty prominent display, back in February 2021, when, I was one of the 12 million Texans who lost power for 4 days during one of the coldest snaps we've had in recent memory. We're not able to rely on others. If we have an issue with our system, we're not able to, pull power from other grids that may have had, power during certain times. And we can't sell electricity or energy to other grids, when we have plenty and other folks are, might not have a bunch. Texas sells energy of all types to other countries and other states, except for electricity.
And when it has more than it needs, it just lets it go. It's wasted.
Yeah, a lot of times we see curtailed, particularly recently, we've been seeing curtailed solar power. So we've not been able to consume all of that energy that we would like to for because we can't export it, or we can't even move it around our own state because our infrastructure is not sufficient.
The February 2021 event was, yes, it was noted internationally. I had a friend from Germany reporting down there, and she had to turn around and come right back because She literally couldn't find a hotel room. And even if she did, it wouldn't have electricity.
Right. So
what has Texas done since then to address what went wrong in 2021?
Well, there were a few bills that passed in the Texas legislature kind of mandating that power plants be better prepared for winter events. Like our grid is built for the summer, and it's kind of showing it right now with, you know, triple digits across pretty much the entire state, and we're setting new peak demand records. And the grid has so far managed, you know, just fine. But our grid was not very well prepared for winter. We had a lot of, you know, pipes freeze, and we had a lot of power plants that couldn't get fuel because our natural gas system also froze, and half of our power plants consume natural gas, and so we weren't able to get them fuel, along with some wind turbines and things that also iced over and weren't able to produce. And so some of the bills have, you know, forced the CEOs of these companies to sign off on the fact that whatever broke was fixed during that event, and to be, you know, better prepared for what's coming. But the thing that does concern me is we have not fixed the natural gas system. And because we rely so heavily on natural gas to produce electricity, if we can't get fuel, we can't make power.
Natural gas being the pipes freezing again? Is that what you're talking about there?
We had a lot of wells freeze, actually. Okay. So we in Texas, we have a just-in-time natural gas system, meaning we're always producing it, processing it, and consuming it. And if any part of that supply chain gets messed up, just like supply chains in general right now, it means you don't get your product.
The grid was built for summer, not for winter. It's so odd to us up here. But that's because that Texas didn't typically have winter events that would burden the system in this way, right?
Yeah, not over the entire state. I mean, we get localized winter storms that would come through, but this was the first time actually in recorded history that all 254 counties of Texas were under winter storm watch at the same time.
Wow.
And if everyone's cold at the same time, they want heat at the same time, they want to consume electricity at the same time, and that can, you know, burden the system.
So in 2022, no problems?
We didn't have any issues. We had some cold snaps. They weren't near as bad. Everything, it's been fine so far.
And the issue about whether or not Texas connects with the rest of the country, that's a philosophical thing, right? That Texas started its grid independently.
Yeah, so power grids were generally started, and this is everywhere, kind of as a local affair. We didn't know how to move power very far, and so sometimes even blocks within cities would have their own power grids and power systems and power companies. And then as technology advanced, we connected them all together. If you look at the edges of ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, that's a grid that serves most of Texas, it's pretty rural in those areas. And so it's not necessarily surprising that lines didn't make it that far kind of early on. And then by the time the Interstate Commerce Clause, which regulates commerce between states, kind of became enforced, kind of realized that, well, our grid is within our state. And if we don't connect it, then we'll have more autonomy doing so. So it's some bit of, you know, historical happenstance, and then also kind of now I'd prefer not to have the federal government oversee it.
And you said that it makes Texas is not able to generate revenue outside of Texas, with the power from its own grid because it's not connected. Is there any sense about what the foregone revenue is?
That's a great question. And I know that we're starting to look at that at the University of Texas. We're looking further into connecting to other states, be that to the east or to the north or to the west, I guess. And we're going to start putting numbers on those. But honestly, I don't think anyone's run the numbers. So maybe that's the problem.
What kind of lessons does the Texas experience have for the rest of us out here?
I think the lessons that are more broadly applicable are around, you know, making sure that your supporting infrastructure is also robust. And so the Texas electricity system assumed that the natural gas system would be there. And when the natural gas system didn't show up, then it created, you know, spiraling problems of not being able to generate electricity, then not being able to move the natural gas around with electricity, then not being able to generate electricity, et cetera, et cetera. We're seeing other infrastructures like water, like cooling water for power plants. You know, if you don't have, you know, cool enough and abundant enough water to cool power plants, you can also run into that kind of issues. And so it's all kinds of the supporting infrastructure. And then the power lines of things actually move the power around. We need to make sure that we're able to do that in a good manner, or even if you can generate it, doesn't mean you can consume it.
Is there been, when this event occurred last week in Ohio and in central Ohio, certain segments of the greater Columbus area were they intentionally shut off the power because it was overloading because of all the storms and the heat and whatnot. And the question is whether or not, you know, why shut down there? Why not shut down another place? Well, that's because where they could shut down and get the most bang for their buck by shutting down, which meant it affected more people because that's where the demand was, what would you say, you know, condensed or, you know, concentrated, right. I guess is the word. Is there any sense that that was a factor or is a factor when it comes to that infrastructure in the grid out there?
Yeah, you can kind of think of the grid as kind of a mesh network of wires. You know, it's not just one wire going one place. It's a bunch of different wires coming into different regions. And, you know, if storms can come through and can take down part of that network, and while the network may still be able to function, it probably is only going to be able to function at a reduced capacity. And then when the, you know, afternoon heat comes and everybody wants their air conditioning and everyone wants to consume electricity, you know, they have to make sure that the, you know, the lines and things don't get overloaded, because if they get overloaded for too long, then they also will go down and you can cascade down into a failure where everyone loses power. And in summers, typically, or when it's hot outside, a lot of the demand is driven by residential air conditioning. That's a very high percentage of the amount. And so typically utilities will look to shut that kind of thing down and keep the power flowing to things like hospitals and police stations and things like that.
What kind of infrastructure upgrades should we consider to make the grid more resilient as climate change, you know, becomes a bigger part of the equation?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to some degree that's going to depend on, you know, the local characteristics and how the climate's changing and what the weather's doing in that region. You know, a few years ago at the University of Texas, we added up like how much did the electricity grid cost? And it was something like $5 trillion, you know, to build out what we currently have. But it's about half depreciated, meaning a lot of the stuff we have is old. And so a lot of it is just replacing what we've got with better technology, with more robust systems. A lot of the power lines we have were built in the 40s and 50s and 60s when demand and commerce and everything was booming, and they've been great, but everything has a shelf life. But then also taking into account what the lessons we've learned about, you know, big storms and climate, things like in Louisiana, maybe burying some power lines because they get hit with hurricanes over and over again. Or if there's regions in, say, you know, Ohio that are getting tornadoes or other kinds of, you know, severe events that are taking down these systems, making them more robust, potentially even undergrounding, burying things so that, you know, they're not subject to these types of disasters.
And I know this isn't exactly grid related, but it affects the demand on the grid during extreme times. And one of the problems in Texas is energy efficiency of structures.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, people were living in basically cardboard boxes compared to what we do up here and experiencing these extremely cold temperatures, meaning they were cranking up their heat. That plays a role as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, Texas homes are generally only built to withstand about 25 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, which is probably nothing from where y'all are at in the wintertime. Energy efficiency absolutely works. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, as an engineer, I always try to work with gravity, with water, with heat, because they never stop working and don't require energy inputs, right? And so making your home more efficient allows it to be more comfortable for less money and, you know, less energy. And so making smart energy efficiency upgrades or minimum requirements, depending on your region, is an absolute no-brainer when it comes to, you know, making sure that we're able to, you know, supply everyone with the energy they need.
But scaling it up to a level where it'll affect, you know, the impact on the grid, that's a whole different story. Because so many of these people can't afford it. They're poor.
Absolutely. And that's a lot of times we have these low income weatherization programs and things like that. And those, you know, can be very helpful in, you know, getting people the energy services they need.
Joshua Rhodes, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Joshua Rhodes is a research associate at the University of Texas, Austin. He works in the area of smart grid and the bulk electricity system. That's it for now. Stay cool. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.